some, living within the structures of their perceived birth gender is a given. Life is easier, it's more predictable, perhaps it's even safer. But what is the experience of those growing up as transgender children in the gender-segregated countries of the United States and Canada? Hello, everyone. I'm Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Mind Talk. I am very pleased to introduce you to today's guests, who will walk us through some of the experiences and answer some of the questions that I have posed. Dr. Ann Travers is Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Simon Fraser University in Canada. And Dr. Travers is also the author of The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. Dr. Travers, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hello. Thanks so much for giving me the opportunity to talk about my book.
Well, Dr. Travers, I'm also going to start with asking you to talk about you. You are referred to as they, not he, not she, but they. Can you help us understand this?
Well, I don't get offended if people refer to me as she, but I feel more comfortable with they, them, and theirs. Because, you know, ever since I was little, I never really, you know, felt any resonance with the label girl or woman. You know, I can live okay that way, but it never really fit in a deep personal way. But switching to being a boy or a man would not make me feel any more comfortable. So I, like many others, want more options.
So that takes us to, or it takes me to, asking you to define for the audience what exactly transgender means. There's, for so many people, there's so many myths about what even the concept does and does not mean.
For sure. The category of transgender is an umbrella term that many of us use to refer to ourselves and other people who don't fit neatly into the gender binary or don't feel comfortable with the sex and gender that was assigned to us at birth. Within trans communities, there are different feelings about what words are appropriate as any community. You know, like, not everybody agrees with the terminology, but it's a general term that refers to people who are either gender nonconforming or who do not feel comfortable with the sex category assigned to them at birth.
You have written a book, clearly, that focuses on the experiences of transgender children in Canada and the United States. For some people, for many people, I know you've heard this before, the theory is this is just a new thing, this is a phase, this is not really real, this didn't exist in my day. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I say that by making it so impossible to tell anyone or to live as a transgender person, it's been driven underground for such a long time. There have always been transgender people. But if you think about the amount of effort that people go into teaching children what sex they are and teaching children that there are only two sexes and that being a girl is very different than being a boy, you see that there's a lot of social effort involved in maintaining this structure of only two sexes, and that the consequences for people who defy that structure have been intense. They've been criminalized, institutionalized in psychiatric institutions, subjected to coercive behavior therapy, shock treatment, etc. There's a high risk of violence for people who are visibly trans or gender nonconforming. So if it was really natural that there were only two sexes and that the two sexes were fundamentally different, you wouldn't see all this cultural energy and all this effort to make sure that people conformed. It would just be that way.
And you know, as I think about it, even within the male-female concept of gender, for so long there were such clear demarcations between if you're a boy, this is what you like, and if you're a girl, this is what you like, that the idea of someone being other than either or has got to be frightening to a lot of people and really, really confusing.
and terribly oppressive to those of us who have a wider range of interests than the sex category assigned to us would dictate. It's not very good for children to have parts of themselves denied or suppressed. I mean, why should children have to, you know, only pick purple or pink or green, blue, and brown, et cetera? Like, why not be able to wear the clothes they like? You know, why should kids who have friendships with someone of the opposite sex, you know, experience, you know, teasing or you know, have it made weird that they're like that? I mean, it's just not healthy for kids. We're teaching them that there are only certain parts of themselves that they're able to express and show.
So we're teaching those children who experience themselves as transgendered, we're teaching them that they, the very essence of their experience is wrong. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes, and we're also teaching people who, kids who feel relatively comfortable with the sex category assigned to them, that there are parts of them that they need to suppress to be accepted.
They need to suppress, or they need to fix, or they need to change?
Well, they need to suppress,
okay,
because you never really give up parts of yourself. You tend to hide them, but having to hide those parts of yourself that you are, you know, told aren't acceptable, it does damage to your psyche. It makes you feel that there's something wrong with you. So even someone who's relatively happy as a boy or a girl, if they love pretty things and they're a boy or they're really artistic, they experience some censure for that, and there's that sense in which they're not wholly acceptable. And children need to feel loved and accepted in order for them to develop in healthy ways.
It sounds like we, just as a society, need to do a lot more work in accepting our children, no matter how they experience themselves, as they are, and not trying to put them in such tiny boxes very often.
I think so. I mean, that is my message, that imposing gender systems on children is unhealthy for all children, and it's particularly damaging and traumatic for trans children. But one of the things that I also emphasize in my book is that we need to do a lot better for children in general. Children should not be separated from their parents at the border. They should not live in poverty. They shouldn't experience racism. For Native American and Indigenous Canadian children, they should be funded to the same level as, you know, regular kids. They should have the same opportunities for education. What I'm saying is that if we're really concerned about making life better for trans children, we have to make sure that every aspect of their life is healthy, because there are trans children in every population. Most trans children are invisible because they know it's not safe to come out. But any environment that you're in with a group of children, there is bound to be a trans kid in there, even if you don't know it.
Any environment. It's, let me quote from a study that you quote from in Growing Up Trans in a Gender Segregated Nation, in the gender segregated nations of Canada and the USA. Excuse me. One in every 137 kids between the age of 13 and 17 identifies as transgender. If you think about it, that's a pretty large number.
Yes, and I think it would be even larger if the consequences for being gender nonconforming or trans were not so harsh. Many kids, like myself included, it was, when I grew up, it was impossible to express that, and so I drove it underground, and I was, you know, consumed with self-hatred because I didn't fit what I was supposed to be. And many kids are still in environments like that, even though, you know, there's more room for girls to participate in sports, etc., and, you know, boys do succeed in, you know, following artistic careers, etc., but it's still, you know, the predominant message is still that boys are boys and girls are girls.
And if you're anything other than that, there's something wrong with you.
Like, something deeply wrong with you, and in fact that you're, you know, you're almost despised and hated. So if you think about that, that being transgender is associated in many people's minds with being, you know, fundamentally depraved, psychologically ill, like it's like a kind of an evil. So if you have those feelings, you're going to try to talk yourself out of them for the most part, unless you're in an environment that's particularly welcoming and supportive. So if we did not live in gender segregated contexts, and if the messages weren't so relentless about what boys are supposed to be like and what girls are supposed to be like, and that there are only two sexes, if it was possible to see gender as a spectrum and we saw examples all around us, I'm sure that one in 137 would be a higher number.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is there a point at which, or is there an age at which a child tends to know what their experience is?
It really varies, but I've had parents report that their children were as young as two when they were insisting, "I is a girl," like really loud.
So for the parent,
and being incredibly upset when they were treated as a boy.
So for the parent who has the two-year-old, and you know, I mean, the truth is that in this society, two-year-olds aren't given a whole lot of credit for knowing anything about anything except how to say no.
Yeah.
So for the parent of that two-year-old, what would you like that parent to do?
Say, okay.
That's it.
And yeah, and refer to them as a girl and use female pronouns. And if they tell you a different day that, no, I think I really am a boy after all, then you switch back. Let your children lead. I believe that everybody should have the right to determine their own gender, and that means allowing room for exploration.
So for the parent who says, but that's going to make my child's life so much more difficult, and I'm going to ask you in a second to talk to us about an African-American, not African-American, I think he was something else, child, Finn, mm-hmm. I believe.
Finn, he's European-American.
European-American. All right. There, then, and Finn killed himself at the age of 14. But before
did.
I ask you to tell me more about Finn, I want to say a couple of things. First of all, you make it clear that much of your book is really written from the perspective of the children themselves who are living this experience, which I think is
mm-hmm.
really important for folks to understand and take hold of as they're going through your book. The other thing that I would like to underscore is that for the parents who are saying to themselves, either my child is too young to know, or maybe my child really thinks it, but I don't want it to be true, that does more harm to the child and to the parent and to the family as a whole than to say, okay, let's see where this takes us.
Yeah, it does. It does do harm to them because you're shutting them down. But at the same time, parents of children who are vulnerable make strategic decisions about keeping that child safe all the time. But if the child feels that you are genuinely in their corner and you are negotiating safety with them, then it doesn't have to be damaging. There are some contexts where letting your kid go out of the house as the, you know, presenting as the gender that they feel that they are can actually place them in harm's way, and the kid might agree with you. So you, like the parent and the child, may say, I know you're a girl. I'm very worried about your safety in going out of the house or in this context. I can't keep you safe. So, you know, you can negotiate, okay, at home, you wear what you wear, and you're a girl, and, you know, we're going to work towards making the other environment safe for you to show up as who you are, but I don't want you to be harmed. And for sure, some parents would think that this would be inevitable, because it's true. Having a transgender child means that they are more vulnerable. But parents of vulnerable children, you know, whether they're vulnerable on the basis of race, or poverty or disability is a difficult thing, and parents have to navigate this all the time. So, you know, it's difficult. It's an absolutely terrifying and horrific thing to know that you cannot keep your children safe, and many parents experience this every day. So it's understandable that a parent may, you know, be very worried that their child will be harmed or damaged if they are openly trans, you know, if they assert their affirmed identity in public. You have to work with the kid to decide the level of risk that, you know, your kid is comfortable with. Because some environments are incredibly dangerous. If you know, if you're crossing a border, for example, and your child presents as, you know, the gender category they really are, you may get hassled by the you know, the customs, the border officials, and you may understand that being hassled might actually be more harmful for your child. You need to know your child, and you need to work with them. If they feel that you are solidly in their corner, sometimes the two of you have to negotiate issues around safety. But it shouldn't be that you are preventing the child from expressing themselves because of your own fears.
And a child can tell. Children are a lot smarter than, as adults, we often give them credit for.
They know who is in their corner. That is one of the things that they are so attuned to, because it's necessary for their survival.
And clearly, you have reminded us that they can know as potentially as early as two. So you don't want to disrespect the child's view of themselves just because it's not something that you were prepared for. It's not something to agree or disagree with. It either is or it isn't. Your child is who they say they are or they're not. And it is just so important to be respectful of your child's view.
Yeah, and children are exploring, you know, themselves and the world. And you should definitely cheer them on in, you know, experiencing who they are. And, you know, that involves a lot of exploration. Sometimes children are absolutely adamant. They know what their gender is, like, from a very early age. And other kids aren't sure. And rather than telling them, it's great to, you know, give them a lot of encouragement to explore, to understand gender as a spectrum, to be exposed to many different kinds of genders that people, you know, represent, so that they feel there are a whole range of options. Then they can find where they really fit.
The parents, you know, often blame themselves for one thing or another. Take responsibility for one thing or another when it comes to their children. We're going to take a break shortly, but when we come back, I would really like for you to talk to us, or talk to those particularly who have the sense of, if there's something that's going on with my children or my child that is outside of what I believe to be the norm, A, I'm a bad parent, B, I caused this, and take themselves through such an incredible shame spiral that there's almost no space for them to see their children. So that's where I'd like to pick up when we come back. And we are going to come back in just a moment. Folks, you are listening to Mind Talk. I'm Pamela Brewer, having a conversation with Dr. Ann Travers, who is author of Growing Up Trans in Gender-Segregated Nations of Canada and the USA from the Perspective of Kids. We'll be right back. And to the folks who, to the parents or the caregivers who say, if this child is anything other than my version of what a cookie cutter child should look like and behave like, I have done something wrong. This is my fault. This is my shame. What do you say to those folks?
Well, I do understand, because I'm a parent myself, and there's this perpetual fear of failing our children, because we want what's best for them. So if your child is struggling in any way, there's always that feeling, oh, if I had done this, maybe it would be better, or I should have seen this coming. So that the self-criticism that we engage in can be pretty paralyzing, but it's really not anything to, it's not warranted, because if a child is trans, there's nothing wrong with that. It's society that has been telling us that there's something wrong with children who are being trans. So in a way, you know, society provides a disabling environment for our child. Our child is not disabled, you know, fundamentally, if they are trans. You know, gender is a spectrum. Children can fit on any part of that spectrum. And when we fail our child, we don't get behind them and support them. So rather than flagellating ourselves for somehow causing our child to identify in a way that will cause difficulty for them, we should get behind them and start trying to change the environments that make life difficult for them.
I want to go back to the title of your book. You talk about gender-segregated nations in Canada and the USA. Are there fundamental differences between the two?
Can I just clarify that my book is the trans generation? The gender-segregated book is a publication,
yes,
of the Williams Institute. My book is the trans generation, how trans kids and their parents are creating a gender revolution. There are differences.
Thank you for that, absolutely.
That's okay. There are differences between Canada and the USA in that public health care is fairly well established in Canada. It doesn't mean it's perfect, and it doesn't mean that affirming health care for trans people is distributed evenly throughout the country. But, it, you know, that is a significant difference. And, you know, there are other differences as well, but there are many commonalities, and gender segregation is certainly one of them.
What about racial differences? You speak a lot about the fact that you have your own experience as being someone who is white, who has class privilege, mm-hmm, and has professional status, and you distinguish that from some of the children that you talk to and some,
yes,
of the folks who... So tell us about that. Why the distinguish?
Well, it really shapes our lives. I mean, we have, you know, how we are read racially definitely influences the life chances that we have. I was at the border, the Canadian U.S. border with my child recently, for example. She's black, I am white. As we got to the border, I realized I'd forgotten my passport. And I told her, I think they'll let me through with my driver's license. And I said, but when you're old enough to travel alone, it will be dangerous for you to assume that this will be possible, because my race and class privilege, you know, it's like a white magic carpet of privilege. And my gender nonconformity, you know, can be a bit of an issue, but I feel like my white privilege and my, you know, visible class privilege tends to smooth the way for me, you know, in encounters like that in general. Like, I don't experience racism, which can be very debilitating and horrible. I am not struggling with poverty. I am not an indigenous or, you know, native Canadian person who is living in a white settler nation that, you know, denies a history of colonialism and genocide. It really has an impact on my ability to, you know, to live my life. I live, you know, mostly in a very sort of trans and queer friendly bubble. I'm a professor at a university. I live in a, you know, in a West Coast city, and my life is pretty great, to be honest. But trans people who are racialized or in poverty or in, you know, more conservative environments have very different life experiences. And I think it's incredibly important when we talk about the experiences trans kids have to realize that some trans kids have way more privilege than others. They have white middle-class parents who are able to negotiate more effectively with schools, who are not, you know, they're not burdened with poverty, they're not experiencing the ongoing trauma of racism, etc. And it really makes a difference in terms of, you know, which trans kids can be visible and how certain trans kids have a better time of it than others, even though all trans kids are incredibly vulnerable.
The idea that you would have to have essentially the talk that certainly many African-American families know that they need to have with their children of color, it's an interesting additional perspective on the urgency and the just the importance of the quote-unquote talk and mm-hmm. the expansiveness that needs to be included in quote-unquote the talk, particularly with children of color who are trans.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, most parents of racialized children don't just have the talk. They talk all the time because we are trying to enable the child to navigate the world as safely as possible. And for white parents of children of color, we're not doing those kids any favor by pretending that whiteness doesn't privilege us and that racism isn't out there. We have to be, you know, very frank and very honest about how being racialized in a white supremacist country negatively impacts them. And, you know, they have to feel that we're angry about it and also that we're helping them navigate it. And for trans children of color, it's more challenging than for white trans children. One of the kids in my book, who is black Canadian, said, "I'm black. I don't want to be trans too." But she is. But she's been struggling terribly with being trans because she just feels life is going to be too hard.
Well, and as you clearly acknowledge, it can be hard enough just to be black or of color. So when you got that added piece to it, it's really quite something.
And for parents of children of color who are navigating school systems and, you know, often having to work with school staff to, you know, intervene in terms of, you know, racist bullying or just, you know, curriculum that, you know, centers the white experience. And then you also have to, you know, address gender. It's very, very challenging. Some of the white parents of white trans kids go into school settings and give workshops on gender inclusivity to the staff free of charge just because it's so important to create that welcoming climate for their child. So it's kind of like, how many things can you take on? But they all
Indeed.
Impact the kid and other kids. Because one of the things that parents of trans kids do and parents of racialized children do when they interact with schools to improve the conditions for their kid is they are improving the conditions for other kids.
Absolutely. In fact, you told us a bit about one of the children whose parents went to school to advocate on their behalf. The school, I think this was a Catholic school, absolutely refused. Tell us that
mm-hmm.
story.
I'm allowed to say her name because she's very public. Her name is True Wilson. When she was, I believe, 7 or 8 years old, her parents and her, you know, arrived at the conclusion that the healthiest thing for her to do would be to be open as a girl at school. She was, you know, she was doing the interim thing of presenting as a boy at school and living as a girl at home. And she describes it as torture, that it was really harmful. And her parents, you know, could see that this was really harmful for her. So they went to the school to announce that she would be she would be coming as a girl the following fall. It's a Catholic school board in the greater Vancouver area. And the school said no. They referred her to a gender specialist. They said you should meet with this gender specialist. But this gender specialist is Dr. Kenneth Zucker, who was at the Clark Institute in Toronto. And he's associated with a brand of therapy called corrective or reparative therapy that uses behavior modification techniques to get kids to conform to the sex category that they were assigned to. This has been he was fired. The brand of therapy has been outlawed in the province of Ontario. It's also been outlawed in the state of California as fundamentally damaging.
It's pretty abusive.
Oh yeah, it's you know, it involves withholding love and affection and privileges from kids if they fail to conform to their assigned sex category. It's coercive. It's incredibly damaging, and it sort of it's a follow up to some of the horrendous government funded projects like the UCLA Feminine Boys Project that tried to coercively change how boys behaved. Not too long ago, the boy known as Craig in the study committed suicide as an adult, and his family attributed it to the therapy he received, which included instructions to his father to beat him if he failed to, you know, behave in a masculine way. So it's a horrible thing to do to children, whether in a gentle or in a harsh way, to try to get them to change who they are. It's very bad for their mental health and well-being. But True's parents were not going to go along with this. They were very clear. So they got in contact with a lawyer who does human rights advocacy for trans people, legal advocacy for trans people, and they took the Catholic diocese to the Human Rights Commission, and they ended up settling out of court. And the settlement, it was partly a financial settlement, but it also involved a formal apology from the Archbishop of the diocese to True and her family for refusing to allow her to attend school as a girl, and they had to change their policy. So the fight that True Wilson and her family engaged in to ensure that True could present as a girl ended up being beneficial to the trans children who came behind her, but True had already switched schools because it was too difficult for her to continue to wear boys' clothing and to use her the name that she was assigned at birth when it just it clearly wasn't who she was.
It sounds like True came from some degree of at least financial privilege to be able to afford all of the legal interactions. Is that true?
Yeah, she comes from a middle class background, and although she is Black Canadian, she is her mother is white, her father is Black, but yeah, they're a middle class family who are both highly educated. And, that helps, being familiar with institutions, even being, aware that something could happen and you could fight against it, that you could get a lawyer. To look around for a lawyer, takes a certain familiarity with the way that systems work. I do not believe that they necessarily had to pay for the lawyer, because I know that Barbara Findlay, who is the lawyer, does a lot of pro bono work for trans people. Huh. She also does work that she's paid for. But there are other families, for example, who have who Barbara Findlay has advocated for without charge because they couldn't afford it. But you have to know. You have to be familiar with the fact that there are human rights codes and that you can challenge them. So, somebody who is less educated or less experienced, et cetera, wouldn't have that information.
Absolutely. I referenced Finn earlier on in our conversation.
Yeah.
Finn, who killed himself at the age of 14. Can you tell us about Finn?
Finn was a trans boy who was very, very much loved and accepted by his family. He was living as a boy. He had, his parents and his family are wonderful people. I've gotten to know his mother a little bit since his death, and she could not have been more supportive of him. And, he was one of the trans kids whose families embraced them right away as soon as he told them that, he was really a boy. They're a middle-class family, but they couldn't afford the hormone blockers that he needed, because they would cost about $1,400 US a month. And their income level was just above the cutoff for assistance from the company that makes Lupron, the hormone blocking medication. So they couldn't get financial assistance to enable Finn to take hormone blockers, and $1,400 a month was just too much.
Sure.
And when Finn's mom, Heidi told him that they had found out from the company that they wouldn't get assistance and that their health insurance didn't cover it and that they couldn't afford it, he was really upset. That very night, while his mother and his family slept, he left the house and he walked to the railway tracks and he lay down on the tracks and he stayed there while the 11 o'clock train ran over his body. And the will, the determination, like some suicide attempts are a cry for help. This wasn't a cry for help. Finn weighed the options. He imagined his body changing in ways that didn't fit who he was and the way this would affect how he navigated the world, and he could not bear it. And in spite of being loved and accepted and supported by family and friends, he just didn't consider himself to have, you know, a good life ahead of him, and he ended it, which is heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
And this is a kid who had so much support. That's what really struck me. His mother, you know, loved him so much, as did his family. I saw the video that they showed at his funeral. His mother shared it with me, and you see all these pictures of a child and young person who is deeply loved, and you know, there's a lot of smiling, there's a lot of hugs, there's a lot of happiness. And so this kid felt he couldn't live. He couldn't live as he needed to live. And so imagine how kids who don't get the support and love of their family and community must feel.
One of the things that it speaks to, I think, that as adults we may forget is that children feel things very strongly,
mm-hmm.
very powerfully. And a lot of times adults don't recognize that. So when they say, well, just ignore this, or, you know, don't worry about that, those are really
mm-hmm.
empty words.
Completely. It's very strange. I just attended a workshop a few weeks ago on the impact of pre-verbal trauma on children, and it was very much in keeping with that theme, that when children are, you know, babies, you know, or very young, if bad things happen, you know, often people think, oh, that, you know, they won't remember it. But the thing is, they experience it, and it resides in their psyche and their body. They just can't articulate it, so they can't, you know, string it together in terms of a logical sequence. But there's this overriding view that children are less real than adults and that their experiences don't matter as much. And there's this tendency to trivialize or dismiss their very real experiences. Whereas, you know, when an adult has a negative experience, you know, it's considered to be real. But we kind of dismiss children. And I think it's part of the way in which we disempower children, in which children are made to not count as much as adults, in which, you know, just being a child is to be disabled by an environment that only takes adults seriously. And we do tremendous harm to children by not taking their experiences seriously, by not, you know, taking their wishes, their, you know, the pain they encounter, etc., seriously.
We are speaking with Dr. Anne Travers, who is the author of The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. And you are listening to Mind Talk. My name is Pamela Brewer. We will be back in just a moment. Thank you. There are some things that people learn to take for granted. And certainly one of them that many people learn to take for granted, and certainly there are many who know that they cannot. And I'm talking about things as seemingly minor as what sport can you play? What bathroom can you go to? I mean, talk about those things.
Well, daily life is organized around sex categories, and children who are uncomfortable with the sex category assigned to them or who don't fit in either category experience trauma and crisis on a regular basis. One of the kids in my book told her mom when she was five, she said, "Mommy, the bathrooms at church make me sad." And the parent described her daughter as standing in between the two doors, you know, the men's and the women's, having to pee really badly and crying because, like, she felt so torn. She knew which one she wanted to go in, but she was, you know, afraid she didn't belong there. And other kids in schools have been physically prevented from using the bathroom by groups of children who've been gender policing them, you know, to the point where they've been holding it, that they've actually damaged their bodies. So the bathroom is a huge issue. A number of parents talked about their children, you know, experiencing incredible difficulty about going to the bathroom. And, you know, many trans people, many trans kids, you know, hold it. They avoid going to the bathroom as much as possible. So think about what that means for your day. I don't know how often you go to the bathroom, but I go to the bathroom, you know, like at least six times a day out in public, you know, sometimes more if I've had a lot of coffee. And it's not negotiable. There are, you know, you've got to go. And most bathrooms, you know, like 99.99% of bathrooms are gendered. And this creates incredible difficulty for navigating public spaces. Also for sports. I mean, many children, you know, as young as 5 or 6 are already having to choose between playing in boys soccer or girls soccer, or playing, you know, if they're dancing, they have to wear, you know, a particular uniform. If they're involved in gymnastics, they train on apparatuses that are specific to girls or specific to boys, and they wear different clothing. So these things organize children's lives in really profound ways, and if a child doesn't feel that it fits, it's really difficult. And even if children are, you know, relatively happy, let's say, being a girl, maybe in gymnastics they've always wanted to do the rings or the pommel horse, but they're not allowed to. Or if they're, comfortable being a boy, but they always wanted to do the unevens, you know, or they don't want to do the rings. This idea that there are specific things that are appropriate for girls and specific things that are appropriate for boys is limiting for all children, but it's particularly traumatic for trans kids.
You know, as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking about the huge assortment of boxes, the either-ors, that we're all presented with in one way or another, and it just seems to serve to make our world so much smaller than it needs to be.
Indeed. And also, like, the pattern of sorting people into male and female doesn't happen in a neutral context where being male and female is equal. There's a long history of gender inequality where, you know, men and boys are privileged over women and girls. I mean, it used to be that women couldn't vote, couldn't own property, etc. So being assigned a sex category had incredible meaning in terms of your access to resources, both cultural and material. And it still does have meaning. Women still earn less, you know, on average than men, et cetera, are still, you know, underrepresented in the highest paying occupations, et cetera. And, you know, there are, you know, significant differences in the way in which men and women are able to navigate the world. So it's important to understand that this pattern of sorting people into either male or female, men or women, boys or girls, doesn't happen in a power neutral context.
What would you like to say to religious leaders or people who perceive themselves to follow a particular religious perspective that says you have to be one way or another? What do you want them to think about?
Well, I think that one of the things that I would say to begin with is that I think that you know, I don't identify as particularly Christian myself, but I think, what would Jesus do? You know, from what I understand about Jesus, he was a pretty right-on guy. Like, he was a social justice advocate, and he was an incredibly kind and compassionate person who was very engaged in building community and bringing people who are treated as outsiders in and challenging people to, you know, to stop distributing resources unequally, to stop shunning certain categories of people. So I would, you know, ask that people think about how their interpretation of the Bible is linked to relations of power that are very harmful to some people and that benefit others. And instead think about really the true roots of Christianity, which is, you know, I think has a real foundation in social justice. So having a religious orientation is not an excuse to create conditions that are harmful for trans people or for women and girls.
To other folks, other professions, teachers, camp counselors, what do you want them to think about? They may personally, individually have one perspective, but they may be required by virtue of their employment to follow another. What would you like for them to consider?
To remember that in any group of children you're working with, you have to assume that trans children are there, whether visible or not, and that organizing children according to sex categories and making statements about, you know, what girls are like or boys are like, or presuming what activities boys and girls, you know, are interested in, etc., is causing harm to trans kids, even though they can't see them. So they should stop. I think that organizing children according to sex categories is harmful, so stop doing it. Instead, teach children good bathroom etiquette so that, you know, they don't have to use sex-segregated bathrooms and that they treat everybody with respect in a bathroom. You know, stop talking about boys this, girls that. That would benefit all children, but it will remove some of the crisis that trans children experience. If you're, you know, telling boys and girls that, you know, boys here, girls there, you're putting a trans kid in crisis. So stop doing it. You know, don't say boys and girls, say children. Like, treat children as people who are, you know, all very different.
There are certainly those who will resist that, because it's so different from the way they've been taught or the way they even think about themselves. I think one of the things that you point to is that when you try to put people, any person in any box, you're harming them, harming their environment, and ultimately, mm-hmm. you know, sort of limiting your own life and your own world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, I think we need to be really frank. This is a social justice struggle. It's, you know, anti-racism is a social justice struggle, and people who benefit from white supremacist systems are going to resist. You know, at least some people are. And it, but, you know, we still have to fight against racism. We still have to, even if people are going to resist the idea of a gender spectrum and resist the idea of accepting trans people, we need to recognize it as a really important social justice struggle, and we can't shy away from it. You know, my values are very grounded in social justice for everyone, and not everyone is going to agree with me, but I'm committed to it.
And it's what guides your life and your research, perhaps.
Absolutely. It always has. I've had a strong strong interest in social justice since I was very young. One of my first memories as a child was of Martin Luther King's assassination. Mm-hmm. And that was the point at which my father explained racism to me and that it was wrong. And that has influenced my life incredibly. And I'm very grateful that it was brought to my attention when I was so young. And I, you know, in a lot of ways, he didn't agree with everything that I did, but it's like he raised a social justice activist by bringing that to my attention. And that's something that I try to impart to my own children, that it's their job to fight for justice for everyone, not just to look out for their own well-being.
And we would certainly have a different world if that were the norm instead of what we're living in now.
Absolutely. And what we're living in now is very troubling, and it's not new. Like, both in Canada and the United States, there's a long history of racism and sexism and misogyny and colonialism, and, you know, the veneer has been ripped off in the United States a bit, but people of color have known that, you know, this stuff has been going on all along, and I think some white people are a little bit surprised lately by the open racism that is being expressed by the White House and other people in the spotlight. But there's a long, long history of injustice in both Canada and the United States.
And that is quite true, and we could probably talk for another 2 or 3 hours about that alone. But we're not. We're going to go back to the trans generation. One of the portions of your book talks about the coping strategies. And while we don't have time to go into a lot of detail about it, I would just like to bring it into our conversation because, again, it underscores how powerful this experience can be for children, for people who are living a world in which their sexual expression is not considered okay. One of the coping strategies you talk about is invisibility, which clearly is just suppressing yourself, sucking it up. But you also talking about, you talked about it with the children you've talked to, the living of the double life, and the self-harming behavior. Talk a little bit more about that. We've got to understand how critical this is.
Well, kids who are not able to live fully as who they are disproportionately at risk for self-harm and suicide. And often it isn't, like, parents aren't even aware that their kid is unhappy with their assigned gender category until there's a suicide attempt or they find out that their kid has been cutting themselves or, you know, abusing drugs or alcohol. But there's definitely an increased risk of self-harm and suicide for kids who are not able to live, you know, fully as who they are.
There's a list, if you will, of behaviors that parents are often directed to at least question whether or not the child is engaging in substance abuse or any other number of things. Changes in eating and sleeping. Mm-hmm. You know the list.
Yes.
Is there anything in particular that you believe that parents should look for in terms of having the conversation with their children about how they're feeling with respect to their gender?
It's helpful if the conversation is ongoing from when they're really small, for sure. You know, that, you know, there are all kinds of different gender expressions and people are different and, you know, our society tends to tell people that there are only boys and girls, but that's not true. Like, that's the kind of conversation you should have with your 2- and your 3-year-old and all the way up. Like, we have those conversations in my family all the time. But if you've never thought about your child's gender identity in any kind of conscious way, and, you know, your child starts seeming to be depressed or anxious or something like that, it's not necessarily the thing to do to say, hey, do you think you might be trans? I don't think that's the way to go.
Okay.
Because, you know, it could be any number of things. I mean, but I think that it's just at any point that you become aware that there are trans kids out there, whether you think your kid could be trans or not, is to start opening the conversation to talk about, you know, there are some people who are trans and there's a gender spectrum. And without interrogating your child, signal to them that you know that there's a range of gender identities, that you think that trans people should be treated well, etc. I mean, that's a way of communicating to your kid that if they do have anything to tell you, that it's safe, just as it is with a sexual identity, a sexual orientation. Families who express openness to gay and lesbian and queer people and trans people, they're signaling to their kids, hey, if you happen to identify this way, you don't have a problem with me. Whereas kids who see their family making making anti-gay statements or who are very conservative around gender and stuff like that, often they know that they can't tell them. And it, you know, it's not accidental that a disproportionate number of homeless and street kids are LGBT. Some of them know they could never come out, and some of them have come out, and they've been kicked out of their houses, or they've experienced abuse because of it. So I'm assuming that the parents that may be listening to this broadcast are not in that category. But, you know, the more openness that you can create in your home, the more that you can communicate an attitude of openness to people of all gender identities and sexual orientations, the more comfort your kid, if this happens to apply to them, will have in letting you know what's going on for them. That's the best thing you can do, is to establish that you are open and supportive. And then, you know, whatever their orientation, whatever their identity is, if they have something to tell you, they're more likely to tell you.
It also sounds like it would be very useful for parents when they are planning on taking their child to any medical professional for any reason, checkup or otherwise, that they need to check with that professional prior to setting that appointment, just to make sure that professional has an open mind.
If their child is trans, you mean? If they know their child is trans,
right.
You have to do a lot of work behind the scenes to create safety for your child. If you're going to take your kid to the dentist, for example, and their birth name is different from the name they are now using, and if they are a girl but their chart says a boy, you need to phone the office in advance and say, hey, my kid is trans. Do not refer to them as a boy. Use this name. And so, like, many parents do this behind the scenes work and their kids don't even know about it. And that's, right. You know, that's what parents of vulnerable children try to do. They try to do advance work so that their children don't encounter harmful reactions from people. Being the parent of, you know, any vulnerable child is an incredible amount of work, and being the parent of a trans child is no exception. It takes a lot of behind the scenes work to get the people that your kid interacts with to behave in a way that is not harmful.
Dr. Ann Travers, author of The Trans Generation, How Trans Kids and Their Parents Are Creating a Gender Revolution. Thank you so much for joining us today. Very quickly, is there a website or an email address or a way for listeners to be in touch if they would like more information?
You can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Baseball. That communicates my other deep passion in life, which is baseball.
Okay.
Or you can go to New York University Press. They published the book.
Terrific. Thank you again very much, Dr. Ann Travers, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk, which is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a mental, medical health, or other professional. You can always listen to Mind Talk on demand by going to mindtalk.org. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening today, and any questions or comments you would like to offer. So email me at Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.